This isn't a problem showing the stories here. This isn't a last week's mile.
Sorry. For that, you'll have to go down the road to the pub.
Welcome, everyone, to our final session on Everyday Ethics with Dr. Derek Woodard Lehman. This has been a wonderful series, and we thank Derek so much for sharing his wisdom and guiding us through some complex territory. Next week, we welcome back Professor Stephen Toole, Professor Emeritus of Old Testament and Hebrew at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. And he is going to talk about biblical responses to current questions. The first session will be the Bible and diversity. I think it'll be fascinating because Steve Toole just knows his Old Testament all the way through, and he'll also bring in the New Testament, and it'll give us some biblical grounding in areas where we're doing a lot of thinking. So I hope you can be with us next week. And now Derek will lead us in prayer a final time.
Thanks, Sarah. Good morning and welcome again. Welcome back to those of you who have been here in previous sessions. Before we get to our topic for today, common grace and common cause in a pluralistic public, let us pray one last time, the little prayer I've used with us in this seminar, but I've prayed with my two sons every day before school since they were wee little boys until they're now as tall as I am. God, give us open minds to learn, open hearts to love, and open hands to share. Amen. So, for the past 3 weeks, we've been looking at ethics in general and Christian ethics in particular. We asked, first of all, what is ethics and what is it that makes ethics Christian? After that, we looked at a few contentious moral issues. Justice, order, and peace in a world at war, and autonomy and agony at the margins of life. Today, we'll try to tie things up and bring things together. We'll do a bit of review about where we've been, maybe pick up some open questions and lingering concerns that we didn't have time to get to in previous weeks, and we'll conclude with the question of whether or not, and to what extent, our convictions as Christians bear on our neighbors and the wider society in a pluralistic public. First, let's cast our memory back at where we've been. We said that the most basic questions we could ask in that very first week were what is ethics and what makes ethics Christian? For the purposes of these seminars, we defined ethics simply as the description and evaluation of human action. Christian ethics on that basis then is describing and evaluating human action based on some set of biblical and theological commitments or another. We said that the first step in describing human action is to identify the ends and means, whether we're looking back retrospectively at something that's already been done, or we're thinking ahead prospectively about what might be done. Whenever anyone does anything, we can look for and identify its ends and means. We said that the end or ends of human action is simply what the agent wants to get and/or what they want to get away from. The means are simply how they're getting or getting away from it. From Aristotle and Aquinas, we learned that we can specify the ends of a human action in terms of its goodness, in the practical sense of goodness, not the moral sense of rightness. But goodness in the sense of desirability. And we can further specify that desirability in terms of something being useful. It's a means to an end, it gets us something we want. It can be fitting, it expresses something about ourselves, and/or it can be pleasurable. It's just enjoyable in itself. All this taken together, the identification of ends and means, the specification of those ends in terms of their goodness, leads us to our preliminary and provisional assessment of an action. Its meaning. We start with what was done and how, and we see why, and this positions us then to move on to evaluation, to find out, to decide, to discern, to judge whether or not the action was right or wrong, good in that moral sense. For the purposes of evaluation, we introduced a bit of moral theory. We said that moral theories illuminate certain aspects of action, they highlight things that we want to pay attention to, and they focus our attention in certain places. We said that no single theory could illuminate everything all by itself. Light creates shadow, and when we look here, we're not looking there. For that reason, we said we wanted to employ these theories together. We first talked about absolutism, which focuses our attention and highlights our commitments, both our personal values and principles, and importantly, our duties and obligations to others. Like our parents, this theory reminds us that sometimes doing the right thing costs us. We lose out, we come up short, we get left behind. But just because it's hard to do the right thing, or doing the right thing doesn't work out so well for us, that doesn't mean it's not the right thing. As the name suggests, we said that consequentialism focuses our attention on outcomes, on consequences. We not only want to do the right thing, we hope to get good results. For hardcore consequentialists, right and wrong are simply synonymous with good results being synonymous with those that promote flourishing, bad results, those that ensue in suffering. Last but not least, and somewhat less obvious, we said was eudaimonism, often called virtue ethics, that focuses on our character. Who it is that discerns and decides how to act. Who it is that we become, both individually and importantly, collectively, in our action. It reminds us that how we describe and evaluate and then act depends largely on who we are in the first place. Now, as I said when I introduced our opening prayer, my children are now mostly grown. They're as tall as I am. They're in high school. But when they were little, my sons loved the cartoon Phineas and Ferb. If you've seen this cartoon yourself or with your kids or your grandkids, you know that it's a show about two brothers, Phineas and Ferb. They build outlandish contraptions in their backyard. They go on outrageous adventures. And they have a pet platypus named Perry, who's also a secret agent. In every episode, their friend Isabella turns up as they're building their contraption and preparing for their adventure and says, "Hey, Phineas, what you doing?" And that question, "what you doing," is the starting place for ethics. Our answers follow from that question. Again, we begin with description of action by identifying ends and means. Ends are what we want to get and or get away from. And the means are simply how we get or get away from that. We can fill out our descriptions a bit more, as we've said, by specifying those ends in terms of their goodness, goodness again in the practical sense of desirability. And we find things desirable because they're useful, because they're fitting, and or because they're enjoyable or pleasurable in themselves. With these descriptions in hand, we proceed to evaluation, where we use those theories to look at how our actions do or do not live up to our commitments, do or do not fulfill our obligations and duties. We look at their consequences, the impacts they have on others in the world, and particularly how they shape our character individually and collectively. With these definitions in mind and these skills in hand, we turned to a few issues. You no doubt noticed that we explored these issues. We examined salient features of these actions and encountered different viewpoints on them. Those viewpoints contrasted and in many ways conflicted with each other. You also likely noticed that I did not offer any final conclusions or answers. There's a reason for that. If I'm out and about at a dinner party or a social function and I tell people that I'm an ethicist, They sometimes assume I'm a smug know-it-all who tells everyone else how to behave, like this guy here. If they stick around and they then find out I'm a Christian ethicist, it gets worse. They assume I'm a self-righteous know-it-all who tells everyone else how to behave and tells anyone who disagrees that they're going straight to hell. Just like Dana Carvey's famous Saturday Night Live character, the scolding church lady. In truth, there are a fair few ethicists who are moralizing know-it-alls. In fairness, there are heaps of Christians who are chastising scolds. Even so, I think these stereotypes are mistaken, and this is definitely not how we proceeded the past 3 weeks in this seminar. As I see it, an ethicist is something like a referee. This is Pier Luigi Collina, one of the most accomplished and highly regarded soccer referees of all time. Collina was not just a competent official, he was a colorful character, with his shaved head and his manically intense eyes. Like Collina, my role in these seminars has been to mind the boundaries of the field and the rules of the game. My job wasn't to play the game itself, that was your job. For those not inclined to sports metaphors, doing ethics is also something like a courtroom. There are procedures and protocols. On the one hand, an ethicist is something like a lawyer, hopefully a good-natured one like the original Matlock portrayed by Andy Griffith. Like Matlock, my job has been to present evidence and elicit testimony. In so doing, I made cases of sorts, but not simply prosecution or defense, pro or con. Being an ethicist is also something like being a judge, though hopefully more serious than Judge Judy. Like a judge, I aimed to moderate our proceedings and keep them in good order, to guard against false testimony and erroneous evidence, to explain the burdens of proof that weigh on your judgments about these several issues. But like a courtroom trial, the verdict belongs to you, the jury. With this metaphor in mind, we might say that the trial has concluded, the evidence has been presented, the testimony has been recorded, and now your deliberations begin. Let's begin by reviewing some of the evidence on our issues before turning finally to our topic for today. Let me give you your jury instructions, so to speak. So we'll start with justice, peace, and order in a world at war. Recall the criteria of just war thinking. On the left side of our slide, we have the jus ad bellum criteria, those criteria that govern the very resort to war, what we called the right to fight. War is not an appropriate response to any old political conflict. You have to have a just cause, paradigmatically self-defense. One nation invades another, or else some grievous injury of right, also known as big bad injustice. Not anyone can make war, only competent authorities, legitimate authorities, nation states can make war. When they do, they have to have a good upright intention, namely to restore justice, order, and peace. You also have to think and calculate whether or not you can actually win. It's impermissible to fight for a knowing lost cause. And crucially, for what we're about to discuss today, as we recap, we have to think about proportionality here at the macro level. We know that war is a terrible, terrible thing. We know that it is destructive and deadly. The means to our end, justice, order, and peace, is very bad. So to justify using these bad means, you have to have significant ends to offset all the harm that's going to happen. Last but not least, war is a last reasonable resort, not a first option. On the right side of our slide, we see the jus in bello criteria that we talked about. These govern fighting rightly. We again see proportionality, not in the macro sense of on balance greater good, but in the micro sense. In a particular part of the conflict, in a specific military operation, is the forced exercise necessary as a means to the objectives in view? And the idea is to use as little force possible to achieve those objectives. Last but certainly not least is the criterion of discrimination or non-combatant immunity. As best we can, insofar as it's possible, knowing that it often is not, we're meant to fight our wars by aiming at soldiers and trying not to harm civilians. Any questions by way of review about these criteria before we turn to some specifics? I'll make sure we have these in mind and everybody's clear. Yes, no, maybe so. Seeing some nods, all right. As we said in week two, things are fairly straightforward with the conflict in Ukraine, but in the conflict in Israel, things are a bit more complicated and conflicted. After withdrawing from Gaza in 2006, including dismantling the settlements and forcibly evicting the settlers, Israel left Gaza to its own accord based on negotiations at Sharm el-Sheikh in 2005, which ended the Second Intifada. So there had been a tenuous peace for almost two decades before the attacks of October 7th and October 8th by Hamas and Hezbollah, respectively, which initiated the most recent cycle in the conflict. Given these circumstances, the jus ad bellum questions are somewhat straightforward. At least in the initial phases, this was a war of self-defense, aiming to eliminate hostile forces, recover hostages, and restore the justice, order, and peace that had been in place for nearly 20 years. However, the war has drawn on now some 2.5 years. Questions about the latest and later phases of the war are more complicated. Hamas has been decimated, at least at the level of its political leadership and largely in its military capabilities. Yet what remains of Hamas continues to refuse surrender, stalls on ceasefire negotiations, and retains some 48 hostages, about half of whom are believed to still be alive. So there are open questions on current operations in Gaza, with both dimensions of proportionality. Whether or not at this point on that macro level, does the continued use of combat as a means to an end outweigh the death and devastation that we see in Gaza? Is it worth it to continue doing this kind of fighting with these kinds of collateral damage when most of the aims of the war are already achieved and there's only a little bit left, namely some 2,000 to 3,000 Hamas fighters? Along with both senses of proportionality, of course, come questions of non-combatant immunity. Given that this is urban warfare where civilians and soldiers are mixed up all together, even after efforts to relocate civilians out of the combat zone, and especially since Hamas tends to locate its forces and arms in hospitals, schools, and refugee camps, is it appropriate to keep fighting? All of this, which begin to raise questions about the continuing upright intention and probability of success. So when it comes to your deliberations and verdict, dear jury, there are several questions you need to answer. Whether combat operations in Gaza with their attendant civilian casualties and unavoidable collateral damage are proportionate in the consequentialist macro sense of being worth it. To eliminate Hamas once and for all, which is Israel's stated aim, and to possibly reboot Palestinian society without Hamas as part of the equation.
Just a question just occurs in my mind at this point. If war is inherently evil, is it possible that war may be necessary? So you might have necessary evil, and is that a conflict from a theological standpoint?
Good. So we have to be careful about what we mean by evil. So on traditional Christian just war thinking, war is evil not in the moral sense of being wrong, but in that practical sense of being bad, being harmful. Because the idea of a just war is that you can exercise force, including lethal force, and not be a murderer. So war is a necessary evil, where evil here means a necessary harm, not necessarily a moral wrong.
We have a We're all deprived of information, sufficient information to know whether war is necessary. But and war is, in some sense, in some very large sense, wrong, because it involves killing others. But also, in a practical sense, it may be necessary. A defensive war may be necessary. So is there some way in which something that is evil can be good?
So again, the terms are slippery. So when it comes to evaluation, we're talking about right and wrong. When it comes to description, we're talking about good and bad in terms of helpful and harmful. So sweep aside the usual phrase necessary evil, because evil functions as both a descriptive word, bad, harmful, and a normative word, immoral, unjust, wrong. So we'll not talk about it in terms of evil because it muddies the picture. So war, because it involves death and destruction, and in the modern era involves death and destruction on a huge scale, and on a scale that largely places the burden on civilian populations, not soldiers. In every war since World War I, more civilians have died than soldiers. That's just how it goes with modern warfare. So that is bad in the descriptive sense of being harmful and undesirable. So you know this going in. It's going to be bad. Things are going to be destroyed. People are going to die. The question that I think you're asking is whether or not it can still be necessary to do those bad things. And that's what that jus ad bellum criterion of proportionality at the macro level is asking. It's saying to go to war is to exercise a certain kind of force, which is lethal, damaging, destructive, and with modern weaponry and in modern contexts is not neat and tidy the way pitched battles on open fields back in the day were. But if the only way to achieve the ends that you're after, ends that you cannot surrender, justice, order, peace of some form or fashion, is to go to war, then war becomes necessary in the sense that you're asking. What the just war traditions try to do is hold the tension between something being bad, harmful, and undesirable, and it's being just in the sense of being justifiable and permissible. One way to think about this is to think about it on the analogy of a medical case. I'm out in the Allegheny National Forest, having a good old time hiking and climbing in those beautiful hills and woods. I take a bad fall, I have a bad injury to my leg, it's broken, and it takes me 2 days to commando crawl my way back to civilization and get taken back here to Pittsburgh for medical attention. During this time, my leg has become gangrenous, and my physician tells me that unless we amputate at the knee, it's gonna go all the way up. Once it gets to your hip and the artery's there, it'll be in your bloodstream and it's going to kill you. I don't want my leg to be amputated. There's no way in which I'm like, sweet, that sounds great. I would love to be an amputee. But given the alternative, given the harm I'm trying to prevent, the amputation becomes a necessary means to that end. So on analogy, international conflict and the injustice that it brings is like the gangrene in the body. And war, on analogy, is like the amputation. It's a terrible thing that nobody would choose if they didn't have to, if they had a different option. But given the alternatives, the continuing spread of the gangrene, the continuing spread of injustice, domination, and aggression, we sometimes resort to the terrible means of amputation. On analogy, the terrible means of warfare. But the idea behind the just war tradition is that if you do it in the right circumstances for the right reasons, and insofar as possible, in the best ways, you are not engaged in a murderous enterprise. So you can go off to war with regret, with tears in your eyes, in the famous analogy of the melancholy soldier, which is attributed to Augustine, but you can come home with your head held high, thinking you've done the right thing by preventing these other wrong things, even though the means of prevention was terrible. So the answer, I think, long way around is war is a necessary evil, so long as we understand evil being not a moral judgment, but a practical judgment. Assuming they conduct themselves within the bounds of just war thinking and within the rules of engagement of a particular conflict, soldiers do no evil in fighting wars in general, though a particular instance might be judged evil in the moral sense. Think of something like the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Handsome gentleman in the back.
So when you say, when you reach that conclusion just now, war is a necessary evil, then when you went on, it sounds like you're saying some wars are a necessary evil and some are not.
Sure. That's another way of saying some wars are just and some wars are not.
Exactly.
And notice that in almost every case, a conflict is just for one side and possibly unjust for the other.
And I'll just throw in that as I'm listening to you, it occurs to me that the idea of trust in the global community in many dimensions is so greatly eroded.
Sure.
At this point in time, we do not trust authorities. We do not trust our enemies. We have a tough time loving our enemies. We have a tough time trusting someone who looks at the world differently than I do. Then it is hard to trust when someone tells you that this war is a necessary evil. If I am one of the allies of the protagonist, I say, yes, it's absolutely necessary. And it would seem that many nations of the world are looking at the conflict in Gaza and saying, no, I really don't buy into that anymore.
Yeah, so all of these things are aspirational, whether we're talking about them in terms of theological standards, moral standards, and certainly the standards of international law. They depend in significant measure on individual persons and collective communities, in this case, nations, operating in reasonable good faith. And we know that people don't always, as individuals or collectives, operate in good faith. So one of the things you'll find, and one of the things we found, if you can cast your mind back to the two Gulf Wars and the War on Terror and the war in Afghanistan, was the question of the United States employing either torture or enhanced interrogation techniques, depending on how you judge those actions, which are generally thought to be immoral and unjust. But the argument, or one of the arguments you would hear, is, well, this just war stuff only works if both sides play by the same rules. So what happens when either in a particular incident or in a broader series of incidents in a conflict, one side seems to be playing by no rules at all, save let's win? How do you yourself as a person or your political community uphold standards of justice when the other side doesn't? Which is just a very complicated version of junior high school when, why do I have to do the right thing, Mom, when everybody else in gym class, you know, dips out and doesn't do the 5 mile run? Well, son, that's because it's the right thing to do. So yeah, one of the real challenges in the present conflicts is the information economy. And depending on what you read and listen to and see, you get not two entirely different, but two rather different construals of conditions on the ground. And again, what have we said all day, every day for the past 4 weeks? Evaluation depends on description. And if you can't get reliable descriptions, it's pretty hard to get to fair and just evaluations. Does that make sense? It's not easy. So thinking about Gaza and closing the loop here before we move on, What we have to reflect on, what you, the jury, has to decide for yourselves, is whether the war in Israel in general, or at least in these final stages of this last operation in Gaza City, is more like the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which were willful, deliberate, direct, and intentional attacks on civilians, or whether or not they were more like our hypothetical example from week two of a munitions factory that also houses workers and their families, combining military and civilian infrastructure, commingling combatants and non-combatants. That's really what we're trying to adjudicate descriptively in order to get to evaluations about the present conflict. Any final questions, lingering concerns, either about just war in general or present conflicts? We've, you know, set aside for today the question of being a pacifist. If you're a pacifist, all bets are off and all of this is wrong and immoral. You don't even get to the particular questions. All right, let's turn to jury instructions for the margins of life. When it comes to the margins of life at the beginning, you have two descriptive deliberations to undertake. If the gestate is or becomes a person, and if so, when? At one end of the gestational spectrum, on the pro-life side of the political aisle, we find, for example, the traditional teachings of the Roman Catholic Church, especially as articulated by John Paul II in his encyclical Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life. On this account, the gestate is always a person from the very first. Life and personhood are co-eval at the very moment of conception. At the other end of the spectrum and on the opposite side of the aisle, we find the pro-choice reproductive justice view of Rebecca Todd Peters, that the gestate, which she calls a prenate, is not a person until becoming a neonate, that is, until a full live birth, even at the moment pictured here on the screen, 20 seconds and 20 inches before the final push, we are looking at a prenate who is not a person, in which case abortion is not even killing, does not require further moral evaluation. These descriptive decisions, of course, have evaluative implications, though they might not be as straightforward and obvious as they first appear. Short of accepting Peters' radical view that the gestate is never a person until born, thus any and all abortion for whatever reason are not even killing and therefore not even a moral question, it remains an open question for you, the jury, if fetal personhood, whether from conception or at some later developmental threshold, issues in prohibitive implications. For traditional Catholic social teaching and pro-life views more generally, it is assumed that fetal personhood issues in an absolute prohibition. If the fetus from whatever earlier or later stage is a person, then abortion is killing as a matter of description. And since the fetus is by definition an innocent person, they've done no wrong, committed no injustice, they have not forfeited their right not to be harmed, and therefore killing them is murder. However, others hold that this conclusion is not as obvious as it may first seem. Pro-choice proponents, including Judith Jarvis Thompson, who we mentioned in week three, propose that even if we describe the gestate as a person, that just means that we have two persons in view, mother and child, who have competing rights and interests. Thus, at least up until the point of viability, they have offsetting concerns that have to be adjudicated. And Thompson and others argue that even though the child may be a person, they have no right or entitlement to imposition on the mother's body. Has anyone seen or heard her famous argument about this? It gets taught in classes a lot. She invents an incredibly novel and rather imaginative hypothetical. She says, imagine you wake up in the hospital, not knowing how you got there or why you're there, and you're medically connected to a patient in the next bed who turns out to be a world-renowned violinist, or perhaps a cellist, it's Yo-Yo Ma. And the doctors tell you that if they disconnect your body from his, the cellist or violinist dies. But good news, they only need to be hooked up to you for 9 months. Now, no one in that hypothetical, Thompson supposes, would argue that you are obliged to stay in the hospital connected to Yo-Yo Ma. And she uses this as an analogy for why it would be permissible to have an abortion up until the point of viability. She concludes her 1971 essay, Defense of Abortion, by saying, "I've been arguing that no person is morally required to make large sacrifices to sustain the life of another who has no right to demand them. I do not argue that abortion is always permissible. I agree that the desire for the child's death is not one which anybody may gratify, should it turn out to be possible to detach the child alive." So her claim is that even if we're dealing with two persons, two sets of concerns and interests, up until the point of viability when the child can sustain their own life, there's no reason for us to suppose that they have a claim on the maternal body. So it's up to you, dear jury, to evaluate if and when the rights of the in utero person offset and override those of the mother. Open questions, lingering concerns about this end of the margins of life. How things stand and what decisions are left for you to make. Ted, can we get a microphone? Mr. Donahue?
Yep. Sorry about that. The projector just checked out.
Oh, it did. Got tired.
I might think that in that discussion of the two individuals that there has to be some consideration for the responsibility of the one individual to help produce the other. Mm-hmm. And that's something I don't think you can just simply abdicate by saying, I'm me and they're them, and therefore something can be decided about them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, if you take there to be implicit responsibility for childbearing in the explicit consent to intercourse, then you have another avenue to say, even at a very early point, you know, you're responsible for this. All right, now for the margins at the other end of life. With euthanasia, we drew some descriptive distinctions right from the start. We distinguished passive euthanasia, pulling the plug, from active euthanasia, pushing the drug. We said that with passive euthanasia, there's a crucial descriptive element, namely that the material cause of death is the underlying pathology. Once treatment is withheld or withdrawn, the patient succumbs to their illness or injury. Just so, passive euthanasia is not killing in the customary sense of taking someone's life, and therefore cannot be murder. But we then observed that with the case of active euthanasia, it's rather different. Here, the cause of death is action rather than inaction. The material cause is pharmacology, not pathology. It is the drug and its lethal effects that bring about death. So in this, active euthanasia is in fact killing, as a matter of description, which means it's subject to moral evaluation. But the customary answers to this question of the permissibility of active euthanasia are fraught. If this is an instance of killing, which I think it's undeniable that it is, what justification can we give for it? Most basically, the answer is it's voluntary. The person wants to die. But in general, we can't murder someone just because they want to die. We don't allow people to kill themselves or have themselves killed, for example, for financial reasons, to dissolve debt or receive insurance for their families. Volition alone does not seem adequate to the evaluative task of justification. We looked at the case of the New Zealand end-of-life choice bill, which offers other reasons, namely compassion and mercy, the relief of suffering. But these reasons raise as many questions as they answer. We said in particular that the disability community reminds us each and every time one of these laws comes up for consideration, that either by statute or by court decision, we are stipulating conditions and criteria for lives that are not worth living. We're identifying conditions which we as a society find intolerable because they're inhumane or subhuman. Yet persons in the disability community live with these very same conditions each and every day. And if we are saying that these are reasons for people to be euthanized, we are implicitly saying these are lives that are not worth living. We, you as jurors, must reckon with that. We also have to reckon with the problem of limitation and restriction, as the experience of the Netherlands reveals. As you likely know, the Netherlands passed some of the earliest laws permitting euthanasia and has some of the most permissive laws. Assuming we find our way to an account of active euthanasia that is killing but not murder, that is justifiable, assuming we reckon with the implications for disability communities, what then are the limits and strictures? Most basically, we require mental competence and moral independence. The person asking to be euthanized has to be in their right mind, not being coerced by someone else. Then we say things like terminal, congenital, imminent or protracted disease, grievous and intolerable symptoms. But those are rather slippery definitions, to say the least. Laws that have attempted to specify some time frame, a terminal diagnosis with a XY number of months or years to live. And it's hard to rule out cases like this one from the Netherlands. This is Zaria Terbiek, a 29-year-old pictured here in the arms of her longtime partner in the home that they shared for many years, just before she committed physician-assisted suicide in May of last year. Her reasons for seeking euthanasia were that she had lifelong mental illness, anxiety, depression, and trauma. As this case and others from the Netherlands illustrate, and as a recent article in Current Oncology observes, in 30 years, the Netherlands has moved from euthanasia for people who are terminally ill to euthanasia of those who are chronically ill, from euthanasia for physical illness to euthanasia for mental illness, from euthanasia for mental illness to euthanasia for psychological distress or mental suffering, and now to euthanasia simply if a person is over the age of 70 and simply, quote, tired of living. This is how things stand in the Netherlands. They've found it hard to constrain the reasons for allowing euthanasia, such that currently a plausible claim to being, quote, suffering from life at any age over 18 is permissible as a cause for euthanasia. So you, the jury, as you deliberate about this particular issue, have to reflect on how, if permissible, can we constrain it such that we're comfortable with who has this option available to them. Questions about the margins at the end of life?
How is assisted suicide that different than just suicide? Because if you wanted to take your life, you can do a gun, you can run your car into a block wall, you can run into a tree, you can, there's so many ways you can do it. This, I'm not an advocate for it, but how is that different than, well, one of the tools in your tool chest, if you're going to take your life, is to go and get something that's more humane in many ways from a doctor. I'm not advocating, but I'm not sure I see a huge difference between voluntary suicide and assisted suicide.
And that's part of the moral challenge. Most states still have laws prohibiting suicide. There are still strong social conventions against it. We do all kinds of things like hotlines and helplines and therapy and assistance. So it's hard to draw a distinction. So there's a contradiction in the offing if we more widely in the United States have, you know, state by state euthanasia legislation that permits. It's hard to say what makes that right and permissible, whereas doing yourself some other way is wrong. The idea, I think, mainly is if people are going to end their lives, we'd rather have them do it in a painless, managed way than another way. But it's hard to, you know, your question is a good one. And again, it's these criteria of exclusion and exclusion. You know, we want to make a box that's big enough for what we want to fit in it, but small enough that these other things don't fit in.
Maybe it's a law, but if you kill yourself, what are the consequences?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if you successfully complete a suicide, then, you know, legislation and social convention don't matter much to you.
Isn't there an inherent conflict in a sort of social value we place on autonomy? You are in charge of your life.
Sure.
With a prohibition against suicide or assisted suicide. So I think of an individual who really is suffering from life and either explicitly or implicitly does things that will lead to their demise. And then I think about the pretense of prohibiting suicide, where we say, you know, you're in charge of your life. Unless we can jump into your business, maybe put you in jail and make you suicidal, and then we'll put you on suicide prevention watch. But in between, there's this vast conflicted space where we say, do whatever you want, but we will condemn you if you die, but it'll be too late anyway, so who cares?
Yeah. So answering theologically, I think there are a number of reasons we can give to say suicide should remain a prohibited action, which is a good setup for the last little bit of our seminar here, which is how much and how far can Christian convictions carry into the public square. Setting aside religious belief, it becomes trickier because our general standard of liberty is give everybody as much as they can have until it bumps into somebody else's. And there are not terribly good justifications for prohibiting suicide on that basis. They run in the direction of what about your friends and family? But most people don't find them compelling, at least in the euthanasia arena. And you know, the legal standard is a compelling government interest. That's what allows the government to start saying no to what we otherwise can do on our own. And so far, the compelling general interest, compelling government interest, is in generally maintaining the lives of its populace. But
so I'll put it in a provocative way to say that I hear you to say that there is an inherent conflict between a social value of liberty and autonomy and a religious value of moral of moral standards.
Yeah, I mean, there are theological and religious conceptions about the sanctity of life, the dignity of persons, and depending on your beliefs, the providence of God, which would run in the direction of saying, you know, this is a decision that's not in your own hands as an individual.
Is there a slippery slope as well? I remember Rahm Emanuel came out and was accused of saying that from a healthcare perspective, that if you reach a certain age, then certain procedures or medicines are not going to be available to you. And I remember there was all kinds of controversy back in, I think it was the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. So the question I have is, as we face these issues, what's the difference between euthanasia, assisted euthanasia, then at age 80, if you're on you have some kind of an illness or some kind of medication, it's not going to be available to you. Are you going to die tomorrow? No. Mm-hmm. But then we're going to assist in your death because you will decline because we don't mm-hmm. either can't afford to as a society choose not to do it. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty slippery slope to me as well. And I understand the practical matter. You can't afford it. The country can't afford to do all these wonder medicines and wonder procedures for everybody. And then you get into that kind of dilemma. But I'm not sure I see the difference between some taking away some kind of medicine procedure or others that ultimately, if not tomorrow, in a short period of time, is going to result in your decline or your death, than, you know, a sponsored euthanasia. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you'll find in the literature on this topic, people raising precisely that question. The way it's usually phrased is, excuse me, at what point does the right to die become an obligation to die? Either for the betterment of society as a whole or for the good of your family, whose meager resources will be depleted by your exorbitant medical costs. And again, the trick with the euthanasia question is constructing a box that's big enough for the cases we want to fit into it and small enough that these other things, and it's really, really hard to figure out what the criteria of inclusion and exclusion could be such that you had a fairly reliable firewall between, hey man, if you're, you know, stage 4 cancer and blah, 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 we think it's okay for you to, or you know, you have a reasonably decent quality of life, but it costs us a boatload of money to keep you alive. We're not going to foot that bill anymore.
To draw that back to the secular versus the faith-oriented approach to this question. In the secular approach, I would suggest that it's possible that we promote an idea that God is not in charge of your life, you are, and you should pursue extreme medical measures to extend it so that if I have cancer, I can demand therapies that the culture has told me will extend my life by 2 months and make me miserable in the process. Other people look at that situation and say, guess what? You don't really have the choice in any meaningful way of how long you're going to live. Your real choice is how miserable you're going to be as you die. And thoughtful people will tell you that with many cancers, you are better off with making a choice for palliative care,
sure,
where you will be happier and healthier, and sometimes even, surprisingly, live longer.
Yeah, in those cases, though, we're back on the other side of the active-passive divide. You're either withholding or withdrawing treatment, so you're not... The underlying cause of death will be the pathology. It will be your cancer. It's not the morphine or whatever it is that your doctor or nurse gives you. And I think those cases both have a greater intuitive plausibility and they're, in a certain way, more self-regulating.
It's not quite as tidy when you get intensive pain management, that where there is a gray zone between providing comfort, sure, and hastening death.
Yeah, I mean, there's things like terminal sedation where we keep you in a medically induced coma until you succumb. And then I think what the case you have in mind, though, is Ted's pain is X. The sufficient dose to make Ted not in pain is Y. But the actual threshold of that medication killing Ted is lower than, so the medical
undefinable.
It's ambiguous. And I think the case law so far has been permissive in the sense that if I'm your physician and I'm giving you palliative care and it turns out that I give you enough of the palliative medication that that precipitates respiratory arrest or cardiac arrest, we tend not to prosecute physicians as illegal physician-assisted suicide. But again, that's, I think there's an intuitive plausibility to those cases, and as ambiguous they are, as they are, they remain in a certain way self-regulating. It's the physiology of the pathology and the relative dose of palliative medication such that we have to give you enough, to give you enough medicine to make you not in pain is also to give you enough medicine to stop your heart or to stop your lungs, which is a slightly different thing than saying Ted is not happy with his quality of life. He will probably live 6 to 36 more months. We are going to give him a dose today that we know full well is terminal and is not palliative. I think those are qualitatively different cases. You don't look convinced.
No. Oh, no. My only skepticism is that life, in fact, is not quite so tidy.
Yeah, there are always going to be edge cases. We work, you know, this is how moral inquiry works. We start with cases where we think the descriptions and evaluations are pretty straightforward, and then we work our way out to edge cases and try to analogically reason between.
To offer a specific case, my father, who reached the age of 94, had had multiple strokes and reached a point where he did not articulate it, but made a very obvious decision that, hey, ich habe genug. Had enough, and he stopped eating. And my sister could not process that.
Sure.
Let's see what we can do to prop him up. And he had he wanted no part of that. You know, is that, that's, you know, that's just the course of that disease. Or, from my sister's point of view, that is a declaration of futility that hastened his death.
I think that's more, I mean, if I were going to carve that example, I would say that's more of a pastoral question than a moral question. I would say that your father does nothing wrong in either actively or somewhat passively refusing or just not eating. The question then becomes, what does the family do? And how does the family process this? And it sounds like, without getting too deep into your personal business, like you seem to have a different and more accepting attitude towards your father's action and decision, whereas your sister seemed to want more aggressive external intervention. But I
think that comes back to the pastoral process of how do people process the idea of death? Do you process it within the context of medical technology,
sure,
or do you process it in a theological perspective?
We are at 10:45 and we just got to the question of the day, which is represented here by, does anyone recognize this image? I'm guessing it's probably fairly recognizable. So it's the White House with the Lincoln and Jefferson, or I'm sorry, the Jefferson and Washington memorials in the background and the EOB off to the right. And it's the steeple of St. John's Church, which is just across Lafayette Square from the White House. But it was meant to capture the, how does the set of commitments we arrive at as Christians bear or not bear on the wider public life? Sadly, we are out of time and didn't quite get all the way there. You know, for example, just to close the loop with this last case that we were thinking about, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8. The 9 of us can make claims about God's providence. We can say that life and death belong to the providence of God, and it's simply not for us to make decisions about when to end our lives. That's a common view in Christian circles. We probably can't legislate that in, you know, public life. So the question today was to be about the common cause and common grace in a pluralistic public, but our conversation took us on other trails, so we'll have to save that for another time.
Thank you so much.